we are now living in a world, and even daily, sometimes even in a shorter period of time, with things like internet and so many other things, how can it be that we have a question in so far as reinventing the faith concern? What difference really does it make? And I wouldn't take your time or my time and energy if I didn't think it raises, you know, very important questions. Okay. Start with a story. About 2-3 years ago, a famous novelist died, and among his papers was found a list of suggested topics for the next book. And the most prominently underscored topic for the next book was this. Just a few words on the novelist's next work. A widely separated family inherits a house in which they all have to live together. I think that sort of sets the direction for what I want to talk about here. A widely separated family, but it is a family, inherits a house. We inherit the globe here, obviously, in which they have to live together. Not many of us are going to be able to live in Mars or on the moon or in space or anything else like that. And obviously this is a problem. We've inherited this large house, this great world house in which, you know, we have to live together. Black and white, Easterner and Westerner, Gentile and Jew, Catholic and Protestant, Muslim and Hindu. A family certainly unduly separated in culture, in language and interests, but clearly because we can never live apart any longer. The old isolationism which I grew up in my little hometown, Kenyon, Minnesota, if that means anything for any of you, where there were 8 Norwegian Lutheran churches within 10 miles. And they're still going. So that was my world. And it was a big enough world for a long time until World War II came, and obviously everything changed because of that. And since my world also expanded because I remember in 1945 another Norwegian Lutheran that I knew, Erik Sæverud, wrote his autobiography, and it's a wonderful book called Not So Wild a Dream. And it's a boy from Velva, North Dakota. If any of you are from North Dakota, that's where he got started. Although his grandfather, this is fascinating, this is way off the subject, but Erik Sæverud's grandfather is buried at, are you ready for this, Holden Lutheran Church, southeastern Minnesota. And that's near where I live, and it's near St. Olaf College, and I always like to show people Thomas Sæverud's, tombstone right there. Anyway, Sæverud wrote a book, Not So Wild a Dream, and his adventures of going out and suddenly finding the world. A long ways from, from Rice County. Okay. And clearly, to survive on the world, people are going to have to learn to live with one another in peace. And what I want to try to do here is use Diana Eck's sort of threefold structure that she has on the board here to say, what does this mean for us in terms of our Christian faith is concerned? What does this mean for us? What does it mean for things like go out and do, the Great Commission, to make disciples of all nations? Or what about the other one? No other name is given under heaven. That seems pretty clear. And therefore, how can we go out with, sort of the older idea, and how does this make a difference so far as reinventing the faith is concerned? Okay, she says there are sort of three options open for Christians. And she's writing for a Christian audience here, as I say, the book is wonderful. She says there is the exclusivist, there is the inclusivist, and there is the pluralist options that we have. And if I go too fast, or if it isn't clear, since I say this is the first time through, and if you're not asleep, I'll assume, that happens. But if you're not asleep, I assume that, you're interested. And even if you are asleep, you might be interested. But anyway, exclusivist means that in terms of religious truth, our tradition has the truth. This is the exclusivist tradition. The others are wrong. Now, that isn't only a Christian position, but that can be the Jewish position. If you know, for instance, the Orthodox Jews, especially the Lubavitches, the one with the long hair and the black hats and all the rest of these, clearly they believe that Jehovah, Yahweh, has spoken to them, and only they and only they have the truth. This is true with Muslims, this is true with Hindus, this is true with Buddhists and everything. But there's the choice we have, and I want to go into this in great detail a little bit later, saying that we have the truth and everybody else is wrong. That's one option that we have. How, the old argument, how can God, reveal truth to different groups? How can truth be divided? How can truth, sort of a little bit of truth here and a little bit of truth there, how can that be? And some people say it can't be, and so they come up with the exclusivist position. Okay. The second one would be the inclusivist position, obviously, just the opposite really here. Now, this one needs a little further explanation. The inclusivist idea is that we listen, we learn, we have dialogue, we share, we cooperate with others, and we welcome them. We don't see them as a threat. We don't see them as necessarily wrong, but we welcome them so long as they finally come around to agree with us. And put things, you know, in our particular categories with this. A lot of jokes could be made about that, but Anchor says, and I think she's right on this, and I want to talk about myself on this a little bit later. She says that probably most Christians are inclusivists. Probably this is the case, where there isn't exclusivism, but there isn't, you know, pluralism either, but most Christians, she thinks are here. Okay. The third would be the pluralist position, and this is the one, obviously, that she's advocating at this, you know, in this book. She says, in our interdependent world, in this world in which we've inherited this big house and we have to know how to live with one another, we come to pluralism. All right. What we have discovered is that no one group can rule all the other groups, no matter how hard we try. No one group is ever going to be, you know, able to dominate, even if they want to do this more than any of the others. And no one, and this is sort of, I think, a fascinating thought here, no one living under an infinitely perfect God can persuade, you know, everybody else. Even though God may, not if, but since God is perfect, we would think that once we understand what God's will is for everybody, we should take that out and they should understand it. And it's, for some people, that's, you know, it's clear now that's not going to happen. If anything, when you take, for instance, the Muslim world or the Islam world or the others, there's even more resistance to this than has ever been the case before, to this particular idea. Okay. So we recognize that we aren't able to convince, you know, the whole world, and that therefore what we have to do is to come back to learn to share, to evaluate, to cooperate, and we have to learn how to live with the neighbors, you know, in this new house. And she says that this option, this third option, is very much a risk. There is real risk taking here because it puts us on an adventure or a trip or a journey where we really don't know the answer. If you're an exclusivist, you know pretty much what's just going to happen. You go out and you proclaim the gospel, the Great Commission, and that's it. And you know, let God do the rest. In the inclusive position, you know pretty much what is going to happen. But in the pluralist position, you don't know, because what you're doing is entering in and listening carefully and absorbing the ideas of other, you know, great world religions. And we don't know, you know, we don't know the ending for this one. We don't really know where that's going to go. And for a lot of people, that's a very risky sort of thing. Let me give you the story that I found with that just exactly, and it has a Holden connection there. One of the students that I had in Chiang Mai in Northern Thailand was the last of the Hinderlies here. Young Andy, Carol and Mary were the founders of the place, and he had six children, and most of them went to St. Olaf, and I had Andy with me, and he was along, and we went to these various Buddhist temples, you know, around Chiang Mai. And the last week, they invited the men. The women are still in sort of a pre-ancient history position in Chiang Mai, so they don't even think about having women involved in anything like this. But anyway, they invited the boys, or the men, if you like, to come and stay for a while in one of the monasteries. And, you know, to get to know it right up hand. And, you know, you can't say no to that. I was the advisor or the supervisor, and you can't say no to that. And then after they went in, I thought to myself, oh my goodness, what if they convert? You know, what if they went into a Buddhist monastery and didn't come out? Or they came out with their head shaved and the orange robe and the, you know, the barefoot and all the rest of these things. Parents had spent all that money and saved and everything else, you know, and they kids from Edina or wherever it is, and suddenly, there were some Americans who had converted. There were a lot of sort of burned out hippies from the 60s. One wonderful story there, we went in to a monastery, and we had been told that there was going to be sort of a hippie who had converted, and he had been there for a long time, and he hadn't had obviously any contact with Americans. And we had all our nice, you know, good Scandinavian kids. We had one girl named Solveig Vegdal, and her hair was just the way her name sounds. It was pure blonde hair. You don't see that very much in Chiang Mai, and so on. And anyway, the priest came out, and he saw us. And he just froze. He hadn't seen, you know, Caucasians for a long time, and he certainly hadn't seen a blonde. And in Thailand, blonde hair is considered a sign of divinity. And Solveig would find, and she had been told this ahead of time, little kids would come up and try to touch her hair just to find out, you know, what might happen, because it was so rare and everything. Well, anyway, this monk, the burned out hippie, looked at us for a long time, and he said, "How did the Sox do in the World Series?" That was culture shock for him too, right? And he hadn't heard, he had, you was from Boston, so he was talking about the Red Sox. So obviously that. But anyway, you get the idea here of it's a risk. That's what I'm trying to say. And what if my boys came out 4 days later and they didn't shave their heads or anything else like that? So there is a good deal of risk. Okay. And today, obviously, we are much more aware of, you know, the opportunities and the teachings of world religions. Any reputable college or university now has, you know, a wide variety of courses on this. When I went to St. Olaf, we had four courses. We had Bible, we had church history, we had doctrine, and we had ethics. And then we had Bible, and then we had, you know, church history, and we had doctrine, and we had ethics. Now we have three people just teaching world religions. We have a Hindu on the faculty full-time, and he's doing just fine. Some of you, Ruth, I think, what would Hugenbeck have thought if he had found out that that if we had a Hindu on the department, or that we had a Roman Catholic as chairman of the religion department? That would have been, an earth-turner, let's put it that way. Okay. So we've got this now. How do we respond? Here I want to draw, this is our bishop, George Anderson, has written a nice book called A Time to Be the Church. And I recommend this. I don't know if the bookstore has it or not. And Bishop Anderson takes this up directly. Now, it's a question and answer format. Does this suggest that there are some kinds of work that should not be done? No, that's not the one. That's what I turned around. Here it is. In our day of so much cultural diversity, how do we still maintain the truth claims of Christianity? There we go. That's the point. In our day of so much cultural diversity, how do we still maintain the truth claims of Christianity? Okay, this is what Bishop Anderson says. In our contact with people of other religious traditions, I think we should not simply say, we have the truth and we're going to teach you the truth. That would be the exclusivist position. He says this. Instead, we should come in and say, let us tell you about Jesus. We need to focus on the figure of Jesus and say, look at this person, his word, his life. This is what we are about, and start the dialogue at that point. We used to see these other world religions as just idolatry. Now the tendency is to view them romantically as better than our own, and I think that's true in many cases. They get all excited about some of this stuff. Okay. The truth may be somewhere in between. Perhaps these religions have the potential for self-renewal and self-cleansing the way Christianity does. Perhaps it is even the contact with Christianity that will catalyze the process or speed up the process, and Christ will become the key for their renewal. This would be a surprising fulfillment of the statement, no one comes to the Father but by me, and I want to talk about that later. Our task is to stay in contact and conversation with these religions, presenting what we know of Jesus as our contribution to their self-transformation. The rest is up to God. That's a good statement of the inclusivist position from, you know, a good authority. Okay, I wanted to read that to establish the where we're going on that point. All right, so.
Could I ask one question?
Sure.
Just to help my mind
sure.
go through this?
Yeah.
When we say pluralism, are we looking at things like Mormonism also?
Now, I'm just talking about the major, Asian yeah. world religion, not yeah. Mormonism, but Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah, when we're getting off into sex, yeah. we're...
Yeah, yeah, that's a good question. I should mention that.
As my mind goes with pluralism, there's some red lights there.
Oh yeah, yeah, right. Oh yeah, no, I'm talking about the world, the Hindu, Buddhist.
I understand what you're saying.
Right, yeah.
Okay,
that's good to know because somehow usually we get along pretty well within the 50 states with Mormons and others. So I mean, yeah. we sort of learn to live there. You know, but is it what about the Islam and what about the bombers of the the Trade Center and. And the other things that are, taking place, in that world. Okay, is that, yeah, that's just the kind of question I like for clarification. You could do others, a Jehovah's Witness.
I'm just looking at one category. If you say pluralistic, are we looking at all of these that basically not, I don't know what you call them, but anyway.
Because we somehow come to terms with, in terms of American church-state relations, we don't have that many problems anymore.
Problems, but Idaho, Utah, if you feel in that area, it's tough. My daughter and son-in-law had to live there for a little while for a construction job, and they didn't want to go back.
Yep.
They were not part of the group.
Mm-hmm. Now, I will say about the Mormons, I'm glad to talk about that I'd want one for my next-door neighbor, but I wouldn't want my daughter to marry one. I do mean that, with all sincerity. Law-abiding, neat, tidy, clean, all those things, wonderful. They don't have Blair boxes or crack houses or anything else like that. Just what else could you ask for a Mormon? Oh, that's good. Okay.
Well, our next-door neighbor's son was in the Air Force out in Utah, and he said they have so many problems that they deny, and he said that he would never live out there. And it was like alcoholism and divorce and abuse. And he said, oh, and they never accept that they have these problems. And he said, they deny it. They think everything is perfect.
Oh, there's a piece. Let me pass the buck on this one. There's a piece about 2-3 issues of Time Magazine back, which is here in our library. And I know the author, Dean Osling, he's a religion editor, and I would say, look at that. That's true. You could go on this. I could do, if you want a session on Mormonism, we could certainly do that.
I'm sorry I did that, but I would say that magazine, though, it's well done.
Don't do what I did, though. We have, you know, the Mormons, the young boys, when they're 18, 19, this is something I respect. If you're 18 or 19 and you're in the Mormon church, you have to go out and be a missionary for 2 years, including this big fellow, what's his name, Bradley, the 7'6" fellow. He's been playing for 2 or 3 different pro teams. And so on, and I could have been making, like this fellow in Minneapolis, he would have been making $15 million a year, you know, playing hoops. But anyway, the two Mormon boys came to our front door and we talked for a while, and then we said, you know, we're happy with the church we have, but we know this Johnson family, four or five doors down, don't ever say that to, you know, to a Mormon missionary. Because when they found out there was an opportunity for them to visit the making up the name Johnsons, they stayed with them for a long, long time. Is that a hearing aid? Is that the, okay, so those things happen. I thought I was getting some message from Salt Lake City. what's the joke that Jesus called President Clinton and says there's good news and there's bad news. And Clinton said, what's the good news? And Jesus says, I'm back. And Clinton said, what's the bad news? And Jesus said, I'm in Salt Lake City. So anyway, you could say St. Louis if you're Missouri or Minneapolis, you know, or whatever, New York, or I'm trying to think of some other ones. All right, you get the idea here. So.
But isn't Mormonism isn't Muslim religion much the same way? Only when they get to be strong in a community or any of the other world religions?
That raises one of the questions that we're talking about here, because have I got the statistics on this one here, that there are now more Muslims than Episcopalians in this country, and eventually, you know, within it by the year 2010, that assume that we're going to get to 2010, and we'll talk about that at 8:30 tonight, but there's going to be more Muslims than Jews in this country, and that's going to raise all kinds of questions for church-state relations, for public education, for all kinds of questions, and this is, so that's why I use the metaphor of the house in which we have to live, that's a biggie. Okay, so do I have this one? All right, now how do I plug into this one? Let's start with some other statistics on this, and you'll see what I'm getting at here about the big house. Okay, in 1996, this is from the Times. From 1996, nearly 1 in 10 U.S. residents was born in another country. That's an amazing figure. In 1996, 1 in 10. American residents, not necessarily citizens, but 1 in 10 was raised in another country. That's twice as many as in 1970. That's just a phenomenal increase. That is, the number of people in this country who were born in another country has doubled in 20 years. It used to be 1 in 20, now it's 1 in 10. People, first generation, the people. Though the current influx doesn't match the 1910 peak, when about 1 in 7 was foreign-born, there's a crucial difference. Back then, the majority of immigrants, 1910, were white-skinned Europeans, obviously. Today, most newcomers are from Mexico, the Philippines, China, Cuba, and India. And St. Paul, as we know, there's a huge number of Hmong people, and that's bringing all kinds of interesting things into the public schools. And they've got their, you know, their will. All right, and stay with it here, Erling. I'm talking to myself, not to you. Okay, all right. This is the other Erling here, and we found each other. The one who's taping me in there is the same, we have the same exact birth date. Robert Kick and I have birth dates on October 13th, 1930. So, all right, that was fun. Anyway, nearly half the foreign-born population is Hispanic. Of these who are 1 in 10, nearly half the foreign-born population is Hispanic, 1/5 is Asian, and 1/12 is black. according to the Census Bureau. If that pattern holds true by the middle of the next century, the United States will be the first racially mixed nation, there we go, in the first world. We've never had any kind of diversity like this before, and neither has anybody else, said sociologist Philip Knighton of Loyola University. The big question of the next century is, what kind of society is America going to be? This is what I mean about reinventing, you know, the faith. How do we respond? We can't go back and, you know, like I had this old uncle, the old Norwegian way was the best, and that settled that, and there wasn't anything more to be done after that solution. Okay. Is everybody going to be behind fences in walled communities, or are we going to have a genuinely multicultural, you know, kind of community? So that raises some very real different questions that we have to deal with. All right, now, how do Christians respond to this? I'm skipping over some here, but I want to get to the heart of what she's saying here. We have, you know, the various options. We have the exclusive, we have the inclusive, and we have the pluralist options by way of response. So that, I want to be sure that's clear when I, you know, go on to the part here. If you were listening to, Paul Harvey, right? If you're listening to Paul Harvey, he would say, and now, the radio broadcaster, he'd say, and now for page two. So this is page two. If you don't know who Paul Harvey is, anybody here know Paul Harvey, just for fun, don't? Wow, just a couple, okay. I thought he was bigger than that.
Paul Harvey, you know him or
heard him. Okay. No, you wouldn't know him. I know he lives down in Phoenix on a very high mountain with lots of, you know, security around him. He's like 90 years old, still going strong. I don't know. Anyway, but page two, Paul Harvey. Okay, there we go. Erwin, get your act together here. All right, so. Exclusivity. What about the idea that there is no other name given under heaven, you know, that's so familiar to us? X says this by way of a Christian response. We say this, but we've never followed this. Just in terms of practice, who is in there, you know, who is ready to say that people who have never heard the good news, people who have never heard the gospel, are people who are going to be shut out from some sort of final permanent reward or permanent hope with God? We simply don't, you know, we don't believe that because in order to be responsive to and be able to respond to the love of God and know what God has in mind for us for eternity, we have to know what the good news was. And you can hardly hold it, you can't hold it against somebody if they've never heard the good news. So therefore, there is a sort of an adjustment, some sort of adjustment that has to take place at that particular point. Okay, and the adjustment, I think, and this is what's happening in what I call reinventing here, there are those who are saying, no, for those who have never heard the good news, you know, there are billions and billions of people all these centuries. For those who have never heard the good news, the important thing now, and this is, you know, X idea, the important thing is the disposition of the heart. If the heart is disposed or open to trying to understand what God has in mind as being the way of how to live, you know, in this world, in response to, you know, to the teachings and the truths and the ethics that we have from God, then that's the important point. Not that there is a way in which it has to be what we would say is, you know, the exclusivist kind of way. See what she's saying here? It's the disposition of the heart. There are those who can well match any kind of disposition of the heart that we find in what we would call the specific Christian community, and who would therefore be in response, would be making, I should say, a response to the initiative of love that God is, you know, that God is issuing. Is that, I want to be sure that's clear. You may or may not agree with that. That's not my point right here. I just want to be sure that's point. That's a very helpful way for me to deal with this. Because we had some people, I remember I teach American church history, and we had some people in the 1880s saying that, you know, millions of people today are going to hell because they never heard, you know, of the Great Commission. You know, that's what X says, that just hasn't ever happened, and we've never lived by that sort of thing. Okay, now, what about the inclusivist position then, given this fact that we have to live in the world here? Now, what we have here in the inclusivist position is something that we're all familiar with. In Christ there is no east nor west, no north or south, but one great fellowship. Okay, we have Galatians, good old Galatians 3:27-28. Neither Jew nor Greek, nor bond or free, nor male nor female. All one people. This means that we believe, if we, you know, we really believe, or there's a wideness in God's mercy, there's another good one for us, okay. This means that we believe that other religion traditions are not really wrong-headed, but that they are incomplete, that they need the fulfillment of Christ. When we say that, we use Galatians 3:27-28, or Christ, there is no east nor west nor these things, we say that other people have been preparing for the reception of the good news of Christ. They have their truths, but their truths are only partially true. That would be what we would call the inclusivist position. All people of faith are seekers here, and Christ is what the inclusivists would say, Christ is what they finally, are seeking. Everybody can be included in the one great fellowship of love, the line from our hymn. So the mix of world religions, what she's saying here, the mix of world religions is not really a threat to us as Christians. We don't see others as opponents, but we see them as opportunity to be able to listen to them, to work with them, and to be able eventually to bring them, in a kind of threatening way around to our way of putting things. Okay, I told you the story. It's not like, the man that from whom Mark College is named, St. Olaf. He was a missionary of sorts, you can put it that way, and he had the sword, right? And except Christian, I have to tell them this story. It's too good not to. The leader of the pagan forces, I love this one, the leader of the pagan forces, legend has it, was a Norwegian by the name of Erling. Right, he was Erling the Leatherneck. At least they didn't call him a leatherhead, but he had a leather neck. Like you see wonderful old Norwegian farmers that I grew up with their heavy, thick neck, and their wonderful patterns, that cross back and forth. And I would sit watching Martin Sorensen, who always sat in the same place every Sunday, and study the neck patterns that he had there. All right, anyway, Erling the Leatherneck came up against St. Olaf, and like in typical Cecil B. DeMille kinds of movies, you always had the hero on each side, finally have the final showdown where they have the swords, like, Tyrone or whoever it is, Charlton Heston or somebody. And so finally St. Olaf is supposed to have said, Erling, accept Christianity or I'll chop your head off. That's the exclusivist position, I guess you could say here. Accept Christianity or I'll chop your head off. And Erling is supposed to have said, chop away. I kind of like that. I don't think I was named for that particular individual, but I don't think my parents would ever name me for a pagan leader. But anyway, you get the idea here of inclusive versus exclusive sort of things. Okay. Now, the thing here, you see, is that the inclusive position is very benign. It's very open. It doesn't condemn. It doesn't judge. But it comes to where we feel we as Christians will be the happiest when everybody comes around to seeing things our way. Okay, let me give you a couple of examples sometimes that I think this will help. I'm doing a work, and I was talking about here last week, on alternative medicine and alternative spirituality. And there are lots of new practices in the church, like meditation and visualization and what we call therapeutic touch, which is very big in some hospitals and things now. What I learned from Eck was that I thought meditation was just about the same thing as Christian prayer. Sounds pretty good. Visualization, as I can go into in some detail, sounds very much like confession. In order to have good, wholesome, visualizing, healthy thoughts, you had to confess, all the shame and guilt and remorse and hatred and jealousy and bitterness that you had. That sounds awesome. like confession. And therapeutic touch is a thing where they draw from the religious and in the healing traditions in India, where there's a universal life force and people who are trained with this gift can run their hands. They don't touch people. It isn't like laying on of hands. They can run their hands over the people and they can feel where the energy is out of balance. It's too hot or too cold or something else like that. You're nodding, Charles, you know what I'm talking about. The therapeutic touch is very popular in some nursing circles today. And the church where we go to in Scottsdale, Sue Denisi is an RN and she practices this and swears by it. And she sees it as a form of religious expression. Okay, but what I'm getting at is that therapeutic touch is not laying out of hands, such as you find in James 5, where you have anointing and hymns and prayer and scripture reading at all. It's not the same, but I wanted to sort of think that it was the same. So what I've been telling my audiences until I read this is sort of a confession here, I guess. I've been telling people, hey, look at all these people from India and all the rest. They're coming around and doing things, our way. Isn't that nice? Isn't that wonderful? See, and I was pretty proud of that and making the point on this, but then suddenly I realized meditation is, something which comes from Asia, and it's no matter how you slice it or how you look at it, it's still, you know, a practice from there. Okay. So, where do we go from here? Now, I would like to try, and I really, as I say, this time was a first time through, to try out a metaphor which may help me, I think it helps me, and see if it helps you to understand what I'm trying to say. Assume, you know, we have, you know, the truth, the all that which is permanent, eternal, transcendent, everlasting, you know, in this thing we call how God has revealed, you know, himself to us, you know, in this world. All right. Say we've got all this material and information we need about God. I liken that to, how should I say this, a large piece of sculpture. And in a museum or in a gallery, and you put the large piece of sculpture, which has different sides to it, and it's not just square or anything else like this, but you find all these different pieces, I mean, you find all these different things that are done to it by the sculptor himself or herself with this, and what you do is that you walk around, and you see it, you know, in three dimensions. It's not a painting or anything else, but it's there, and it, in a way it's like this, fireplace that John Marcus did build here for us about 25 years ago and so on. And I can see part of it, and my other counterpart, Erling, can see part of it. We both can't see part of it, the same part of it, together at the same time on this. And we see different things, but we don't see all of it at the same time. We don't see the total sculpture at the same time. You know, in a way, this is an adaptation, you know, the one about the blind men touching the elephant. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's basically what I'm trying to say here. What part of the elephant do you touch? The tusk, or the toes, the tail, the ears? Where do you do this? And if you're blind, you don't obviously know this. So does that make any sense of what I'm trying to say with God's truth? That there can well be more to what we think God is telling humankind than what we can see. Just so we can't see the whole sculpture at one time. Does that? This is a teaching technique point that I'm asking for here. You may or may not agree with it, but I want to be sure that that this may be helpful, because I might be using this, you know, with some other things also. Now,
are you saying that God might have several ways of mm-hmm. relating to people, different people?
Right.
The fact that we have learned of Jesus Christ means that we are responsible to follow the leadings of Christ.
Right.
And exclusively. Well, I mean, at that point.
At that point, yes.
At that
right,
point,
yeah,
we sure. have heard of Jesus Christ. Right. There's yeah. no other way.
Right.
We are Christian.
Right.
But that it's God's business how he wants to deal with the rest of the world, and we are not the ones to judge them.
That's what I'm trying to
because
say.
Because they are seeing different parts of God. I mean,
right.
is this what
yeah.
you're...
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying.
And
because...
So we shouldn't be missionaries.
So we shouldn't... No, I'm not saying we shouldn't be missionaries. I've got the Great Commission, right. I've got that. But what's happened with missionaries is fascinating. A couple of things. One, missionaries now go out. But two things have happened. They're much more, how should I say this, involved in things like health and hygiene, literacy, standard of living, and these things in other countries, rather than just simply preaching, you know, a straight sort of conversion, or if you're an evangelical, an altar call kind of thing. I know we've got the fellow who's now director of church relations, that's, you know, John Gorder. He and his wife were in Africa for 21 years. And what John spent most of his time doing the last 10 years was helping farmers get, you know, better control over their livestock and husbandry and in sanitation and things like that, because there's no way they could make any kind of further, you know, move towards them until they had got some of these very basic problems in life, under control. Or the other major thing that's taking place is that the churches now are planting their seminaries, you know, in these countries, what we call indigenous personnel. That has to do with the fact that for a long time, you know, that the racial animosities and the hatreds and the suspicions and all this are still very prevalent in a lot of places. And so what they're doing is trying to have indigenous personnel become involved with this. I know my father-in-law is a congregational missionary, and the last about 10 years of his life, Alan Myrick and Judy, his wife, have been working in Africa on that particular, you know, new direction that's taking place. And therefore, since everybody can't, how do I say this? Since you can't reach everybody, you have to find a way in which you can minister to those who do listen and who do respond. I don't know if that's any help with what you're trying to ask, but the commission is there, but the also, as I come back to this point, the disposition of the heart is really crucial on this. Because let me put it this way: what Ed says, religiously, the move to pluralism. Religiously, the move to pluralism away from exclusivism and inclusivism begins the moment that the one we call God is greater than our knowledge or understanding of God. Once we accept that, once we accept the fact that the one we call God is greater than our knowledge or understanding of God, then obviously we are moving towards what Dionysius calls it, pluralism. That's the important point. God knows more than we do. And that's a very, very important point. Now, that doesn't mean, and this I want to be sure I get into this one part of the discussion here. That doesn't mean, obviously, that we are saying that all the religions are the same. That it's not a relativist kind of position. That doesn't come in at all at this particular point. But it does mean that what we can do, and this is where I got excited and why I was so turned on when we got up to Chiang Mai and all the rest of these things, is that we can come to know our own beliefs better when we can compare them to what other people are believing. I think in terms of, if you want to call it self-discovery or self-understanding or convictions of self, why do we believe this particular thing? Why don't we believe that particular thing? We are, I think, strengthened in our own particular convictions much more when we come up to people who have the same sort of general religious instincts, or the same sort of general religious impulses that we do, but see things, through other glasses or through a different kind of perspective. And one, I'll just give you an example. The story. We were out one day in the woods. This was in northern Thailand. We were one day in the woods, and we had the Thai students who were with us were all English majors, and they wanted to be with us because they wanted to practice their English, obviously, and they were wonderful kids, and we had a good time and everything else. And all of a sudden, one of the girls, and we had both Thai, we had Buddhist students, and we had some, obviously, Christian students, too, from Minnesota. And all of a sudden, one of the Thai girls had a heart seizure. I mean, just boom, a real thing, cardiac arrest, all sorts of things. And, not... It was something more than mild panic at this point, way out in the woods in northern Thailand. And what happened was that some of them started to pray to sort of the spirits in the woods. Animism is what we call this, that there were some animists sitting around. Some of them started to pray to some sort of Buddhist deities that might be, invoked at this particular point. And some of them prayed to, the Christian God to come in and do something. And it's a turn. Here was the whole thing. But we all wanted to help this girl. That's what I'm trying to say. The basic instinct was to save her life. That's the point. We could all agree on that. That's what I'm trying to say. We could all agree on that particular point. And that was a marvelous. And I've seen one of my students say, I remember Andy too, Hinderly, still talks about that one. That particular experience, because that was what was necessary at that time. And perhaps, the God we're all praying to was the same God for all the different ways, all the different traditions that were involved in this sort of thing. Does that?
Did anybody know CPR there?
No, we didn't at that time. It was still out goes the bad air, in comes the good. You remember that one when you were a kid and you would push on the ribs, and push on them. Remember that old one, right? We didn't have
CPR.
She lived. Yeah, she lived. Yeah. Right. But,
there's two things that strike me that you said. One is, there's an assumption, I think, that the United States is a Christian country.
I don't mean to offend that.
I mean, that's sort of what I was getting at when you were talking about. I think that we're practicing exclusivism, giving lip service to pluralism. In some of what you've said so far to me.
You mean in terms of Christianity?
In terms of what you've described as the thrust of Dionysius' concerns. Is that we're giving lip service to pluralism, but we're really practicing exclusivism.
Well, she would say that we're giving lip service to it because this is her position, mm-hmm. but she would say that more Christians than not are inclusivists, not exclusivists. And I don't, you know, I just need to, you know, understand more of what you mean by your first point about what difference does it make that the United States thinks of itself as a Christian nation?
No, the fact that you were concerned that there were other races and religions coming into the United States,
right,
that already exists.
Right, yeah.
And it already existed and has existed,
right,
from the time that, right, the first people came,
right,
over.
Yeah. The first Jews came over just a few years after.
Well, the Indians were here even,
yeah,
before,
right,
that.
Yeah, right.
So it's no different, I don't think. I don't see it as being different, is all. Is the,
oh, I think in terms of quantity it is. Definitely.
Quantity,
oh, absolutely.
Quantity it is,
right,
yeah.
Right, you can go through parts of, some of you know this, in parts of San Francisco, too, for that matter, or Los Angeles, and you don't see anything in English for miles. It's just a whole, you know, Miami is virtually, what, two-thirds?
Yeah, it used to be Spanish and Norwegian.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Is pluralism saying that the Indian spirit is the same God as the Jewish God, as the Christian God, as the Buddhist God, as the Shinto God, and we are... We are. They are all personifications of ways of understanding God, mm-hmm, that they have been taught.
Right.
And we have been taught that Jesus Christ is,
right,
the exemplification of God,
right,
and is God.
Right. See,
now, you're saying then that we accept these as equally.
We accept these as we listen to them and we don't see them as threats or as dangers, but we can come to a better understanding of our own position. You know, where we see it by contrast to others.
When we see all of their readings, mm-hmm, and stuff, we see that they have the same, almost the same commandments. You know,
the golden rule, you know, was in every world religion.
I kind of like what old Hugebeck used to say at St. Olaf too, that Christianity, however, is unique in that it's the only one that doesn't have works righteousness as a base, but it's what Jesus Christ did, rather than our accomplishments. And that's how Christianity is totally different. Now, am I being exclusive by saying that?
No, not if you're saying that everybody else is wrong in how they're coming about to understanding what God has, you know, for
if
them.
If I say that Jesus Christ's action won salvation for all men, Buddhists,
yeah, okay,
Shintoists, all the others, who are trying to reach God's purpose in their life,
right,
then I'm being pluralist.
You're
even
saying,
though they don't claim Jesus
the,
Christ.
The pluralist is saying, what, you know, is accounting for the fact, what do we do with all those who have never heard the good news? I mean, we suddenly have to, you know, we really have to account for that. And what
we're saying that Jesus Christ's act one salvation for all humankind.
But they have to come to that knowledge in their own way, since they don't even know that there was such a person as Jesus.
But by this idea of
what I call the disposition of the heart.
The disposition of the heart,
yeah.
If they are seeking God's will in their lives above everything else,
right,
then that, for them, that gift of Christ, mm-hmm, is
what they understand in their in their terms.
Is received by them, whether they know,
yeah,
why they have salvation or not.
Yeah. But there's an evangelical theologian by the name of Clark Pinnock. I don't know if that rings a bell with any of you, who's advocating this position, you know, very, very strongly.
So it's universal salvation.
No, it's not universalism. That's a whole different thing about will everybody be saved. That's a different thing than what we're talking about here.
But those who are seeking God's will,
mm-hmm,
fall under the payment,
yep,
of,
yes,
Christ's death, even though they don't know his name.
And that there's no reason to exclude them because they don't know it.
And it's God's choice whether to include,
yep,
them.
Yes, not absolutely, yeah.
So we ought to be more.
Well, that's what I meant by taking a risk. Be open to what might happen. This is an adventure, a journey, where we don't know how it's going to come out. But we're just on the point now where, you know, to use a metaphor of the house, where we all have to learn to live and cooperate. We have to do that because the old way isn't going to work any longer. Yeah.
How does that relate to the Greek?
Right. Well, what happens to those that haven't been baptized and they didn't know they're supposed to be baptized? Should we condemn them? See, that we have to come to terms with that. That's what I'm trying to say.
But we aren't the ones that have the right to condemn.
Yeah.
No.
It's God's business.
That's right. And
But we have the opportunity to share our love.
Yes, do that, fine.
And share God's love.
Right, but just the sheer numbers have, got to the point where that's simply not physically possible to do that. I mean, these, you know, where I was in these little Thai villages and all the rest, they hadn't heard anything like this. And so therefore, were you swatting a fly or raising a hand?
Swatting a fly.
Well, I was hoping you'd say something.
Well, I was going to say something.
Go ahead.
And what I was going to say was this, then. So there's one God above all.
Right.
Who is the God of all creation, right. All right. Of mankind.
The whole universe.
All right.
And the universe is...
And he sent Christ, his son, into right. The world. Why did he have him say these exclusive things to us?
Who wants to take a stab at that? Why didn't God have the message of salvation through Christ, you know, sent through the whole world?
Well, at least not to have him say that there isn't salvation and no other, and it's only through him that anybody can be saved. Why didn't he leave some doors open?
Jesus didn't say that.
Well, anybody want to? I can rather
stand. Didn't Jesus say that?
I'm sorry?
Did Jesus himself say it, or was it Paul?
Well, there was, what's the one, is John 16:10, there are other sheep in this fold.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah, that's true. That
he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life.
Yeah.
Right.
No one comes to the Father but
that's,
me.
And that's Jesus
the
one, right. That said that.
Right. That's and then we run up against a question, you know, why didn't God tell everybody? Why didn't God send Jesus to India?
But then you can tie into the Great Commission.
I'm sorry?
You can tie in the Great Commission to go out and go out to the world and tell the world.
Right.
And if they believe, they believe.
Well, what if they never had the chance and didn't even know that there was a Great Commission? That's what we're...
There's a good question.
Yeah, you could say that Jesus Christ is saying that I am the only way mm-hmm. that it's possible for anyone to become mm-hmm. acceptable to God. Mm-hmm. And I have won that way for you. I am that way for all people. Mm-hmm. But that he didn't say that they have to know that I
exactly.
am that way.
That's what I mean by the disposition of the heart.
If they are seeking God's relationship to God, the Jews seeking God's with all of their lives,
right.
seeking his presence, it's just that they don't know that the way
that's
is
right.
already made and
we
paid
have to,
for
yeah,
them.
And we have to come to terms with that. We're not going to get the Great Commission is not going to be known everywhere. So that to come back to that point. So
well, not only the Great Commission, but the way.
Right, the way too,
the,
sure.
However, the salvation that has been
in
purchased.
In year 2000, into 2000, with internet, with all the things we have with satellites and so forth, there's much more opportunity. Of course, mm-hmm. with all religions too.
Yeah, for the other religions to reach.
Yeah,
I'm on a couple of world nets where we get some stuff, and whee! Well, I didn't learn that back in Goja County, some of the stuff that we're getting there, but it's fascinating, right?
Yeah, there's junk and there's good. Yeah.
Right.
How about, thou shalt have no other gods before me?
Right. Monotheism, right. And the other world religions do have, with the exception of Buddhism, do have one god. There's Jehovah and there's Allah. There's one God, right?
They're all called different names, but they're
different names. Different names, right?
Like Paul said, "I know this unknown God that you're worshiping. It's Jesus Christ." Mm-hmm.
Would you define disposition of the heart?
Disposition of the heart: the ability to recognize that there is a Creator God, there is a greater supreme being above us, who was, you know, eternal, transcendent, permanent. And that, what does it say? St. Augustine said, our souls are restless until they rest in thee. That there is a direction, a momentum, and energy in this life, which is aimed in that direction, which seeks the good rather than the bad. And seeks that what we would call health rather than disease. And these things like this. And that doesn't have to be, you know, specifically just one denomination or something else like that, yeah.
How is that different from your Unitarianism?
Unitarianism?
What you just said.
I don't think that is very much different, if that's what the Unitarians believe, yeah.
But Unitarians don't.
But they've had, you know, on the other hand, they've... I'm sorry, Ruth?
But Unitarians don't believe anything in unity.
I mean,
they can believe anything, can't they?
Yeah, Yeah, we could tell stories about that.
No.
And sure.
Right, go ahead.
Well, I think we can get it put back down to even simpler. We have for centuries referred to the Native Americans as the pagans.
Yes, heathens.
And I think before we get to be too judgmental, you know, at least they worship these spirits.
Right.
And then we get to affluent America, and I say that the Native Americans at least worship something that God created, but as I see America today, we worship things that man has made.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
and we're worshiping our own happiness, our own pleasure, our own comfort, our own enjoyment, rather than trying to have the directness that he's talking about toward God's pleasure, God's happiness, God's purpose. Right?
You're right.
And as to the degree that any Indian is worshiping the spirit and seeking that God's pleasure rather than our own, to that degree, then you're saying that he is covered by the salvation that Jesus Christ has won. He may not know that he already has it because, and he doesn't have the assurance of saying, hey, I'm in, you know, and being able to rejoice in that.
That's a good point.
And we have that to share with people, but it might be that he is still covered with it.
Let me finish, since I'm the teacher, you know.
I'm sorry, but
I want to finish up here that with a pluralist, what she is saying really is that we don't know where we're going to go with this. The answers aren't in. The exclusivist has all the answers. The inclusivist would say, we know where everybody else is and we want to bring them in there and we don't see these as threats or anything. The pluralist are saying we're on an adventure, you know, like out in space somewhere. We don't know where it's going to go. And it may be a whole different thing. Isn't it they found out with the Hubble telephone? The universe is expanding. You know, I mean, this isn't just this little cosmos that we have here with our, planetary system. That just blows me away. The universe is still expanding. Creation isn't over yet. So that's what I mean. Physical creation isn't over yet. And for some of us, my own feeling is, I suppose I'm preaching to the choir here, but to think, that there is, an understanding of what God is doing only on planet Earth and nowhere else, or that all this other stuff out there is simply secondary to what's taking place here. You know, what you're saying with our happiness and our comfort and all the rest of these things, I think just simply misses the point altogether. And living in the planet Earth with all the implications that we have here, with the opportunities too. I mean, with the internet, and for instance, and the other things, it's no end to what I think might take place. Thank you. This was fun. I'm going to learn from this myself. I don't know if you learned anything. But read the book. Read Diana Eck's book. It's a very, very good book.